Next on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker have a Left and the Law segment about the rights to free speech and free assembly guaranteed by the First Amendment and legal challenges in mobilizing for direct action on climate justice.
Well, this is Labor Day, at least in the United States, and among the many undervalued and underappreciated forms of labor is the work of activism. And this summer, as Fran just noted and listed, activists are working to prepare for a week of climate actions, including those going on today. In trainings for direct action tactics, which often involve the potential for getting arrested, activists are often instructed in their rights under the First Amendment. I went to a training a week or two ago, and the trainer asked us what our understanding was of the First Amendment to raise our hands, and there were very few hands that went up, including, I confess, to my own hazy understanding of it. So, Mike, let's talk about the First Amendment. What are the rights included in the First Amendment? And then we'll get into their implications for activism.
All right, Jen, I think the First Amendment is at the core of what's good about this country. The first part of it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What that means is that there is no religion or no ideology so obviously true that we all have to bow down before it. And that the second part says, you cannot pass a law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So everyone in this country is free to worship in whatever way they want or not worship in whatever way they want. Again, it's because there's an implicit contract here, an assumption that the truth is not glaringly obvious, and the best way for the truth to emerge is to let people continually explore and express themselves and let the rough and tumble of exchange of ideas and which ones surface is the best way to find out what's really going on. The next one is the freedom of speech. Closely related to that is freedom of the press. These mean that you can say whatever you want unless there's some sort of imminent danger. You can abstractly advocate for the overthrow of the government of the United States. But if you're saying to somebody in the heat of the moment, punch that person, shoot that person, that's banned because force and fraud that's immediately available is something that you cannot advocate for. But other than that, virtually any sort of speech in any sort of form is protected. Finally, the right of the people to peaceably assemble is guaranteed. That means you can gather, and so long as you're not threatening other people, you can gather in any size you want for any reason you want. It's primarily aimed at power, points of power, either corporations or the government. And you are allowed, finally, to petition the government for redress of grievances. These guarantees have basic assumptions about how society should be ordered and give guarantees that allow people to stretch themselves mentally, to not have to feel like they've got to constantly look over their shoulder to know whether or not any sort of expression of ideas is going to bite them.
Like any abstract principle, the devil's in the details and how it gets applied. And that's why God made lawyers, right, in courts to decide these things. And around hate speech, there are continuum of positions within the left, both in terms of what constitutes hate speech and where the limits on the First Amendment guarantee of free speech, and then tactics to resist it. So we can, and I'd like to start with the first part of that, the first question. How might we think about the meaning of the term hate speech and the resistance and organized resistance to forms of oppressive language once you move from an era where assault was understood as physical assault to an era that recognizes language as itself injurious, assaultive, potentially traumatic to people?
Well, the First Amendment is very tough on hate speech. It basically is...
Tough in what sense?
It's tough in the sense that it's very repeatedly been held to be protected by the First Amendment. The way you will cope with hate speech is not by passing laws against it. The First Amendment sets aside the government in all sorts of contexts. The way you combat hate speech is with more speech, with more creative demonstrations, with more forms of expression. You don't combat hate speech by going to the legislature and lobbying for a law that then relies on the police to enforce it.
So one distinction you're making is in how you enlist the law or the police to subdue the other side. So let's talk about the recent Proud Boys fascist gathering in Portland and the counter anti-fascist protesters and the rally. I was there a few weeks ago, and there were a lot of debates in terms of how to counter this. So how would you frame that issue and the tactical, and I guess there's also political, ethical issues as well as legal and tactical ones in terms of how you fight these fascist groups?
Well, to begin with, you are free to have those tactical discussions. In fact, that's the creative way to combat bad ideas. Like what happened here is, first, there was enough widespread opposition to the Proud Boys that the counter-demonstrators exceeded them greatly in numbers. So there was a greater mass, a greater physical expression. But more importantly, I think, there was the creative ways in which people resisted. There was tons of ridicule. White flower was opposed. People dressed up like bananas. They were expressions of ridicule that diminished the overall gravity of the white supremacist acting as if civilization is hanging in the balance unless our race is protected by shifting gears, shifting tones. They were minimized.
I'd like to add a caveat to that, because when I was down there, one part of the rhetorical strategy of resistance that seemed to get a lot of applause was, get out of the Rose City. This is our town, you know, like we're a city of love. And this drawing to some extent on the fact that they were outsiders from rural areas. And
well,
I think
that's a very provincial thing to say.
Well, and
do.
It's kind of, it can be very reactionary. You know, you don't belong in our town. And of course they are, and they don't represent all of rural communities. So there's, I think, this potential to rally people around a false sense of urban unity against rural, you know, these cowboys coming in, gunslingers coming into Portland to disrupt our peaceful town. I mean, there was some of that talk.
Well, that's not very, to me, that's really provincial. That's like small villages uniting against the outsiders. But that's a matter of tactics, Jen. That's some, I think it's not a good way to go, and I would strongly advocate against it.
Okay. And if you know the history of Oregon and racial minorities as outsiders, it can help to caution against and to think about your rhetoric, your unifying rhetoric.
Well, that's where one of the beauties of the First Amendment is, that it enables minorities to convert themselves into majorities. Otherwise, a majority could not be stopped from passing a law banning all Republicans or freezing themselves into position.
So we can acknowledge and support the right of the Proud Boys or Nazis to be present and to gather in our city, but we also have the right to shout them down.
Absolutely.
And oppose them.
Absolutely.
But that there is also the movement toward nonviolent civil disobedience partly is a moral and ethical position for many people, but it's also one that acknowledges that your rights stop once you start hitting people or engaging in violence in terms of rights guaranteed under the First Amendment. That doesn't mean that violence isn't a tactic that shouldn't be considered at some point, but it isn't protected, you're saying, by the
First Amendment.
Yeah. Well, can we talk? Go ahead. You want to say more about that?
I want to say that a critical part of the First Amendment is protecting insular minorities. There's never going to be more African Americans than white people or brown people in the state of Oregon, for example. But Oregon cannot pass a law limiting or infringing upon their rights in any way. So you not only allow minorities to convert themselves into a majority, but groups of people who will never be more than 50% are permanently protected in their rights of expression by the First Amendment.
So this this also extends in a, there's a gray area around civil disobedience or the right to petition the government. We, in our last minute or so, would you want to say anything about First Amendment rights and direct actions that involve the risk of arrest, how they're carried out, perhaps the necessity of these actions in light of other, the failure on the part of the state? I mean, we can't go into the whole basis of the necessity of defense as a legal strategy, but can you say anything in closing about civil disobedience?
Well, it's a critical way of raising issues that simply cannot be resolved by op-ed columns and discussions. And necessity defense is primarily a defense. That is, it's guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment to subpoena witnesses, to cross-examine people and present a complete defense. But the First Amendment is involved, like a big demonstration against financiers in Broadway and Wall Street. And 4 years ago, people were not allowed to present a necessity defense, but the court acquitted everybody who was arrested on grounds that the police officer's orders for the protesters to disperse was overbroad. So their First Amendment is something that you're always, it allows you to get on the edge, and particularly when there's a dire urgency, it allows you to come as very as close as you can in your expressions to working for the changes that you feel are needed.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker today talking about the First Amendment, knowing your legal rights, and actions on the streets.
Well, let me tell you about the climate dance. It's easy to do. You're nervous and you jump because this world's nearly through. So down some more tea, watch some foreign TV. Put your mind on anything but the truth. Leader's got a climate dance, it's easy to do. You grab hold of the treaty, then you tear it in two. Then go back to your people and spin me all about how the earth ain't gonna come to no harm. We gotta cut our emissions by 95%. You can fritter your money, but I tell you we're already spent.